Friday, September 30th, 2011, and welcome to episode 124 of Tech Talk for Teachers. I'm Tom Grissom. This episode, we have an excerpt from a recent presentation given by the 2011 Illinois Teacher of the Year to a group of EIU Free Service teachers from earlier this month. The Teacher of the Year event was organized by the EIU chapter of the Association for Early Childhood Education International. We also have another Teaching with Primary Sources segment where we will be talking with Dr. Cindy Rich, the director of the Teaching with Primary Sources program here at EIU, about natural disaster resources available from the Library of Congress. September has also had a large number of technology-related announcements, so I will also share my technology pick of the week. First up, we have Anise Brave, the winner of the 2011 Illinois Teacher of the Year Award. She recently talked about a variety of topics related to education at an evening event here on campus. Her talk covered current educational news items, including the movie Waiting for Superman, the Save Our Schools March held this summer in Washington, D.C., how poverty is impacting our local schools, and she ends her presentation by sharing her recent experiences with the other Teacher of the Year Award winners from across the United States at Space Camp in Huntsville, Alabama. Without further delay, here is an excerpt from the 2011 Illinois Teacher of the Year presentation given by Anise Brave to teacher education students here at Eastern Illinois University.
I started thinking a whole lot about Superman and what it means to be a Superman for kids. And, you know, what this movie meant. Have you all seen it? They'll probably make you watch it in one of your classes one night, okay? But in this movie, there are four kids that are featured. And I think that these kids are the lucky ones. Even though they are struggling in bad schools and their parents are trying to get them out of school, the school that they're in, and move them to a better charter school, you'll find that these kids have caring adults in their lives. They're going to turn out okay. I have to wonder about all my kids in school, those kids who are foster kids. Many of them have been in foster care their entire lives. The kids whose parents are in jail. The kids whose parents are unemployed now, and that's happening more and more. I used to have kids who could get a job to help their moms out, but now there aren't any jobs for them to even get to help out. Kids with parents who are so overwhelmed by life that they really can't help out their children. What about them? Well, for many of those kids, they're not waiting for Superman. Superman is already there for them. Sometimes it's me. Sometimes it's one of the other teachers in the building. And before long, it's going to be you. And you've got to be prepared to be Superman for some kid's life. Not too long ago, I went to the Save Our Schools March in Washington, D.C. Did you hear about it? Has anybody seen the Matt Damon video? You got to watch it. You got to YouTube Matt Damon at the SOS March. It's funny. He took on a reporter that said some insulting things about teachers. And so if you want a good laugh, Google YouTube for Matt Damon at the SOS March. But while I was there, I got to hear Jonathan Kozel, Linda Darling Hammond, Diane Ravitch was there, Nancy Flanagan, all the people I look up to as education leaders. And Matt Damon was there too. I took a picture of Matt Damon because he was the cutest one, okay? Did you know that Matt Damon's mom is a professor of early childhood education? Did you know that, Shannon?
No.
Yeah. I think she made him come to this march, okay? But while he was there, he gave the best speech. And as a little aside, I'm kind of a stream of consciousness teacher. He sent a bus down to New Orleans to load up a bunch of New Orleans teachers to bring them to the march. And when they got there in Washington, D.C., he met the bus. And when he got on, he found out that they had never seen our nation's capital. So when he got up to speak, he said, guess what, they're gonna be late because I sent them out on a bus tour to see all the sites in Washington, D.C. But he was, you know, an awesome speaker. But one thing that happened is when Jonathan Kozel got up to talk, have you read Savage Inequalities, Amazing Grace, any of those wonderful books that he's written? They're probably in your future sometime. But he got up to speak, And he told the crowd that when we take poverty out of the equation, our nation's schools are still the best in the world. Did you know that? When we look at schools that have 10% or less poverty, those kids' test scores are still above all the world's schools. So you have to ask yourself, in this country, are we really looking at an education problem, or are we looking at a poverty problem? And I think we're looking at a poverty problem. My high school, Alton High School, 2,300 teenagers walk through our front doors every day. Some of them have car keys to brand new cars, brand new Mustangs. Some of them have fistfuls of credit cards, the latest iPhones. Other kids are climbing down from the school bus. They're walking down the hall to get their free breakfast. Then they get their free lunch. These kids lose weight over the weekends. Christmas vacation, we pack their backpacks full of food, just so they survive till they get back to school. We do not have an education problem in this country, but we do have a poverty problem. In my classroom, and we're a dying breed of high school. Anybody want to be a high school teacher or already teaching high school? Good for you. We need more men in elementary level, though. You ought to think that. But I put that in just for you, Dr. Carter, okay? When at Alton High School, the same year that U.S. News and World Report said that we were a top-performing high school in the nation, the U.S. Department of Education told us that we were a failing school. There is nothing like what happens to a faculty the day we go into the mailroom to check our mailboxes, and we see thousands of letters going home to parents telling them that they are now, they can ask for school choice. Just like that, it burst our bubble. We no longer felt like a top-performing high school. We felt like failures. And we'd worked our tails off. Tails off with all the extra things we do for kids. And, you know, I don't care what the Department of Ed says, my high school's a winner. Right before I went to the SOS March, I've been at International Space Camp, and these are some of the other teachers of the year, and they look pretty silly. We are a silly bunch. This is the teacher from Washington, D.C. He dressed as somebody wrapped up in red tape. This is the teacher from Wisconsin. She's got her cheese head there. Bozeman. This is Paul Anderson. He dressed up like Evel Knievel. I did not know that's where Evel Knievel came from. Samoa, dressed up in her native costume. This, you can't really tell it, but it's a Pez costume. Connecticut. Did you know that that's where Pez is manufactured? The Pez Corporation gave her a Pez costume to wear. That's me in our mock-up of the International Space Station. Yeah, we were pretty silly. We had a great time. And there is young Mr. Jeff Epps, one of my favorite students in the back of the room. You made it, sweetie pie. I'll tell you stories about him later. But this is my team at Space Camp, Team Kibo. Kibo is the Japanese word for hope. It's also part of the International Space Station. It's right there. And after hanging out with Teachers of the Year, there were 55 of us, 50 teachers from the States, 5 territories, and then there were other teachers from around the world who were invited to come to International Space Camp with us. But after hanging out with them for a week, I have a lot of hope now for our nation's futures. You talk about teacher leaders. Man, hang out with these teachers of the year for a while. They will just make you feel so good about public schools in our country, because most of them were from public schools. While we were there, we got to hang out with rocket scientists, astronauts, people who were recruited by Wernher von Braun. Now they're called the old Germans. And they would all tell the same story. Wernher von Braun would call them up and say, "You must come to Huntsville. If you don't come to Huntsville right now, you're a damn fool." And they all told the same story. Imagine that kind of vision, that kind of power, to be able to recruit people to come into the space program. For a team of 400,000 people who put us on the moon. The same people who were planning to have us on Mars by 1986. Before, you know, the funds dried up. But we got to hang out with these guys, Dave Christensen, just fantastic, telling us about building Redstone rockets and how the program grew as he grew with it. This is Max 9 from Germany. He's one of the old Germans. It was all I could do to keep from calling him Dr. No all night. He invited us to his house, and his wife cooked us a Thanksgiving dinner. She thought that, you know, in July in Huntsville, Alabama, we really needed turkey. But anyway, it was very sweet of them. But he has his whole basement set up like a little museum for NASA. And this is his mural of the space shuttle that he worked on. And he told us all these great stories about what it was like to meet all these astronauts and get these shuttle missions ready. This is Sonny Maria, Frank Maria. He told us great stories about one night when they were drinking beer, standing around a piano, trying to figure out how they could keep tires from exploding on the moon. Because the moon buggy, the LRV, they couldn't figure out how to get it to move around. They knew that tires would explode. They're standing around a piano. Next thing you know, they've taken all the piano wire out of the piano, and they've started building tires that'll work on the moon. Ought to go to Huntsville, Alabama. Go to the Davis Building. Look at the LRV they have sitting in there, and you're going to see wire wheels, piano wire wheels. And that's what drove them around on the moon. He told about them trying to figure out how they could have seats in there that would hold an astronaut, and then it was like, well, we're hardly going to weigh anything. They went out and they got their deck chairs, slapped them on the LRV, the moon buggy. And if you look at it, you're going to see it's basically lawn chairs that are on this thing that drove them around. Homer Hickam, who wrote Rocket Boys, you may have seen the movie October Skies, telling us what it was like to work at NASA, the creativity. He told us stories about his teacher. He had tears in his eyes as he told us about her giving him a calculus book and saying, you can do this. You do not have to spend your life in a coal town, in a coal mine. You can do this. He also told stories about her praying while they were setting off rockets at nighttime using real pipes instead of the stuff that most rocket kits are made from. Ed Buckby. He was their PR guy. And he hung out with all of the astronauts. And he knew them inside and out, and telling us about the glory of those days in space. Bob Springer, mission specialist on two missions to the International Space Station, told us cool things that we could share with kids. How to go to the bathroom in space. Why you throw up in space, and what not to do when you throw up in space. Why your back hurts in space. All these cool things that occasionally, you know, a kid will start talking to me, and I'll say, well, do you know why your back hurts in space? And no, I didn't know. Well, I can tell them why, and I can tell them how to fix it. I also saw a lot of this when I was at space camp. Asian kids. And I'm not talking about necessarily American Asian kids. These kids happen to have come from mainland China. Yes, mainland China spends thousands and thousands of dollars sending kids to American space camp. You're probably aware that China is planning its moon mission right now. And you're probably looking at some faces of their next astronauts. They still come to America. They still have these kids use shuttle simulators, even though the shuttle program died a week before we got there. It's still American ingenuity. And this made me think about what I just heard a couple weeks before that. This is Michelle Shearer, the National Teacher of the Year, and this was taken on July 4th, the day she got back from Beijing. And bless her heart, she was so jet lagged, but we still went out to dinner together because we promised we were going to do this. And she started telling me about her experience in China. She said that like the last day she was there, she was alone in a room with all these Chinese teachers. And when they saw that they were finally alone with her, they just kind of like glommed up on her. And they said, "You've got to tell us about American schools." And she said, "Are you crazy? Look at your test scores. I should be asking you questions." And they said, "Oh no, we must make our schools like American schools because we have got to teach our students how to be creative." Now think about this. How can you teach creativity? I don't think there's a person in this room, I don't think any of your professors, and if they were being honest, I don't think anybody in this country would say that we are not at the top of the world in teaching creativity. Just think about it for a while. When I was at Space Camp, I watched the teacher from China as she followed around the STEM teachers talking to them. Sometimes she had her translator with her because her English was very poor, but sometimes she was alone just talking to them. So I thought, well, she wants to hit up all the, you know, science and math teachers while she's here. So I was really surprised the day she sat down next to me at lunch. And honest to God, she said, "Hello." And I said, "Okay, honey, we have to work on that first." So by the time we were done, she was just saying, "Hi." So we were okay. But she asked me, with all the earnestness in the world, "How do you teach imagine? How do you teach imagine?" And I was kind of expecting this question after talking to Michelle, when I knew that they were asking her how she teaches creativity. And what was I going to say to this Chinese teacher? Was I, you know, I watched Tiananmen Square. I knew about the Cultural Revolution in that country where they just, when they destroyed books and Western musical instruments. I did not want to send a teacher from mainland China back on some kind of educational suicide mission. I couldn't tell her that good art, music, literature, creativity walks hand in hand with freedom. What could I do? So I decided to give her some concrete examples of how I teach Imagine. I teach Imagine when I tell my students that they're going to climb up onto a scaffold with a young woman who's been sent to a strange world full of wild animals and hostile indigenous people. And when she gets there, she's going to fall in love with a worm who doesn't even have enough guts to stand up and tell people that he loves this woman and that they had sex. We're going to stand there with her as she holds her baby on this scaffold while the townspeople jeer at her. And she looks out and she sees her long-lost husband show up. And we're going to stand there with her as we watch this man plot revenge against her and her lover. It's better than anything on MTV's 16 and Pregnant. That's how I teach Imagine. I teach Imagine when I tell my kids to jump on a raft and I push it out into the Mississippi River. And on that raft is a child of poor white trash. He's been beaten. He's been neglected. And on that raft with him is a runaway slave who's desperately searching for his own children. And they go off on a mission together to discover morality in an immoral world. And they're going to fall in love with this kid. They're going to fall in love with this runaway slave. And they're going to learn that there is hope. There is redemption, and a deformed conscience can be saved. I teach Imagine when I have them run around with a disaffected youth who's a rich kid, but he's had a very poor life at home. The only person who really loves him is his younger sister. He's still suffering from the loss of a brother that he loved. And all he has left from that brother is a baseball glove on which his brother has written poetry. And he winds up in a mental institution, and the only person he has to talk to is a psychiatrist. And as my students try to figure this out, and there are no loose ends, no nice, tidy endings to this story, I stand with them as they try to make sense of a modernist tale that often doesn't make sense. That's how I teach Imagine. I also teach Imagine as I have my students climb up a six-story tower with an aging English teacher as she ziplines into a lake. She rescues an astronaut who's underwater. She survives her own underwater rescue. And then she climbs into a chair where she is lifted back up into the helicopter and has her own life saved. That's how I teach Imagine. I also teach Imagine as I have them get in Space Shuttle 101 with me, the last flight of the Atlantis, as I safely land the Atlantis and bring it home. Mission Control is going crazy at this very moment because the old lady is the only one who got it on the black line when I landed it. Other people got stuck in the swamp. They landed in treetops, but not me. I was flying. It's a little short. It's not easy to land a brick from space, okay? But there we go, and the crowd is going wild. I was so happy that they named me Commander. You never know what position you're going to get. I found out that why there's a commander and a pilot on every shuttle mission. Have you heard this? It's because all these guys who become commanders and pilots are top guns. None of them want to be a co-pilot. So they had to change the names. There's a commander and a pilot. The commander still lands it. The pilot gets to deploy the parachute and the landing gear. So she was pretty important too. And there we are as the crowd goes wild when we land. The little lady from Romania, when we were giving high fives, she didn't know what was going on. She thought we were trying to hit her. Okay, that was fun. It was awesome. Okay. And I teach Imagine. When I tell them that an Illinois Teacher of the Year from their high school got to meet the president, it's awesome. Awesome. And only the Illinois Teacher of the Year gets to fist bump him. Kevin Rutter got to do that last year, too. And he's one of your alums. And so he told me, he said, you've got to be sure to fist bump the president. So I did. And this is how I usually end my speeches. Because I don't care if you decide to teach like a champion. It's a good book. You should read it. Okay? Teach like a rock star. Or teach like your hair's on fire. Where do they come up with this stuff, okay? All I care about is that you teach your butt off, all right? And whatever you do, always teach with your heart. Because kids are going to forget most of the lessons you teach them, but they are never going to forget how you made them feel. So thank you, Eastern, for inviting me. Thank you for putting my picture up on the wall out there. I was thrilled when I saw it. We took all kinds of pictures of that, didn't we, honey? And I love Eastern. I hope to come back. So thank you all very much for tonight.
Teaching with Primary Sources segment this month, we have Dr. Cindy Rich back with us again this month, and the topic that we're going to be talking about this month is natural disasters. Welcome, Cindy.
Thank you. It's good to be back. You know, one of the reasons we were talking about natural disasters is because there had just been a lot of press about the earthquake in Washington, D.C. last time we had met. Mm-hmm. And so we talked about that and the damage to the Washington Monument and some of the other things that happened and just, you know, how we were really interested in at that time. And so that got me thinking about that this is, natural disasters is not a topic that someone would think about and then automatically go to the Library of Congress to look for resources. Yeah, it's just one of those things that they would tend to go somewhere more science-based or something like that. And so I thought, what a wonderful opportunity to showcase just the diversity of the primary sources and the other types of things that are available at the Library of Congress on a topic like natural disasters that occur.
And, you know, you mentioned yesterday, I did see an item on the news about the engineers rappelling down the Washington Monument. I did catch a segment on that, to see what the damage was.
Right, and the video from when they were inside the monument.
I never did see that one.
So, yeah, you know, we're documenting all of these moments in time, and it's amazing to have that moment that when the earthquake hit and the people that were inside, and now how they're going to repair the monument and what they're going to do to try and make it where we can all go back and visit once again and see the monument. So I thought, you know, let's talk a little bit about that. Also, just to help, you know, once again remind teachers that primary sources are created for every event, not just the big historical events, but every event that occurs, and they're available in so many different formats that you can find ways to make them work in your classroom, and they may just be that tool, that little piece that's going to help you connect with one of your students. Mm-hmm. And so even though a story can play out, you know, on the other side of the globe or just somewhere within your own state or community, if it doesn't directly impact us, sometimes we tend to forget about it pretty quickly.
Right.
And so some of these primary sources will showcase how something that happened many years ago is still something we can relate to, or, you know, very far away. So I just thought we'd talk about some of the different scenarios relative to nature being at its extreme that are reflected in the Library of Congress, and then how those can be applied to different classrooms, different disciplines, and, you know, just more tools that we can put into the hands of teachers to help them when they teach these things in their classroom.
Okay, sounds good.
Well, first of all, I thought, even if we just talk about the basics of what a natural disaster is, and there are things, you know, here in Illinois we think of earthquakes and tornadoes. This summer we dealt with some flooding early in the summer, down especially in the southern part of the state. Now we've had sort of a drought going on, and, you know, but these are things that we've talked about throughout American history, and so things like floods from hurricanes and tsunamis or the rivers. We talk about the drought and the heat waves, but we also have to remember the Dust Bowl that was a huge part of our history. And so all of these things that are within the collections, just at the very basic level of recognizing what they are. So even if you just go, if you just want to play around on the website and go to the homepage, if you do just a simple homepage search at the Library of Congress, I entered flood and came up with almost 6,500 matches. And these were, you know, things like photographs and maps and newspapers and song sheets and just a diverse mix. But what was really cool is it gave me these matching terms or supporting terms. And so those were things like floodplain, flood control.
Right. So a teacher could put together a vocabulary list or
exactly.
something like that.
Or even with students just getting started, you know, some teachers will say, although Wikipedia may not be a good place to research, it's a great place to start because it introduces new vocabulary. And that's kind of what this does, where you put in flood, but all of a sudden you're exposed to all of these other variations of flood. And, you know, it gives students another way to branch off into that topic or to think about. So, you know, going through that, of course, there were different things that caught my eye, especially the Mississippi. And so I've started just looking around at all those items, which is a lot of fun just to explore. I also went into the Today in History page, and we've looked at that a couple of times now from the Library of Congress homepage. And instead of doing a date map or a date search like we did last time, I put flood in the archives. And it was really cool because when it came up, it had all these matches for dates that were relative to floods. And things like in 1775, the creation of the Army Corps of Engineers. which I, you know, hadn't even thought about.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, there was information about the building of the Hoover Dam and how it was relative to flooding. So, that, you know, there are all these things that we don't have to specifically talk about a flood that's happening right now.
Right.
But we can talk about one that's happening right now and bring in our history
right.
with our students to show how, yeah, you do need to be aware.
Right.
This is happening far away from us, but it is relative.
Right. But also, since it is a national collection, a teacher could kind of zoom in on whatever particular geographic area they were from.
Sure.
You know, like out west, Hoover Dam or something, or concentrate, like you said, on the Mississippi.
Right. Absolutely. So, you know, from starting at the beginning, I just did the very basic to see what was out there. And that's what I found. And then from that, I thought, okay, well, what about if I went into specific disciplines to see what was available? And one of the things I hear all the time is from science and math teachers. What does the Library of Congress have that right. I could possibly use?
Right.
Math, I still struggle with.
Mm-hmm.
But science, we're finding more and more
mm-hmm.
in that. And it may be, you know, there's amazing collections of maps and Landsat photos and all of these things. But also throughout history, you know, the papers of Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln have reference to weather
mm-hmm.
occurrences
mm-hmm.
and things like that. So to maybe connect to
mm-hmm.
something being studied in a history class or a social studies class or language arts class.
Right. Well, as a former math and science teacher, just a little bit of imagination. There's all kinds of uses and things with the floods and getting, you know, students out there to do some real science. Calculating flow rates for the river, for example.
Oh, sure.
And then going through, I mean, there's just, you know, you could take it a number of different ways out there. But again, I always like to tie it locally, you know, with what the students are used to. So,
well, and that's one of the things we talk about, historical events and things that happen either far away from home or a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And students are like, why do I really need to know that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, once the test is over, I don't want to think about that anymore.
Right.
And so if we can find a way to connect it with their personal life,
mm-hmm.
then maybe it's like, oh, okay, yeah, that does matter. I am interested in this
mm-hmm.
one way or another. So another thing that a lot of people miss in the library is something called Everyday Mysteries. And the Library of Congress has a kids and family section. And those are the homework helpers and all of that. And but there's something called Everyday Mysteries in there, and those are science questions.
Yeah, I've not seen that one, so I'll have to check that one out.
It's a lot of fun. And one that caught my eye, it said, can it rain frogs, fish, and other objects? And it talks about how, you know, the old stories about right. it was raining animals, where usually it was a water spout or a tornado or a hurricane mm-hmm. or something like that.
Or raining cats and dogs.
Exactly, right. And I'm sure if we go into some of the folk life stories, we can find things on that too. But whenever I started looking into this, it was talking about how water spouts and tornadoes can suck things up in and throw them somewhere mm-hmm. else. And that's where these stories all came from. And so you go into these everyday mysteries, it gives you that. But then again, it links to these primary sources, these historical documents and historic photos that are available. And I'm assuming we'll put links to these on the website,
sure.
right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, got the links out here. So, yeah, we can add those to the show notes easily.
Yeah, so, yeah, but those are a lot of fun. And there's also an area where students can ask their own question and submit it, and someone from the library will answer that question for yeah. them.
And I suspect they're probably pretty good about getting back. I mean, what a wonderful motivating thing for a student to get an answer back from the Library of Congress.
Oh, absolutely. And the library is excited whenever they are yeah. asked questions
yeah.
like
or a
that.
Teacher as a class, you know, submit that. You know, hey, I have our class has a question, and submit it. And
yeah, right. So, and yeah, to be engaged personally mm-hmm. with the Library of Congress. Beyond science, you know, of course, geography. You know, looking at the maps, and the maps of the Library of Congress, they're, again, in that digital format. They use a technology called Mr. Sid, so you can zoom
in.
It's
been around for a long time, yeah.
You can zoom into those maps at a very close mm-hmm. level and study what, you know, are in those maps to really, you know, do detailed research mm-hmm. as they're looking at it. And so they can look at things like how landscapes have changed over time
mm-hmm.
and just, you know, general information like that. Within the map collection, you've got conservation and environment maps, and then cultural landscapes and all these different topics that you can look at. But you can see how these natural disasters have impacted how our country looks. I mean, even as, like we were talking about Southern Illinois, they were talking about moving the levees and things like that are going to change where it flows, and so farmland was going to be flooded. Mm-hmm. All of that changes our maps and how our country looks. So it's,
yeah, and that happened this spring with the floods. They had to blow up certain sections of the levee, and that's, you know, man-made levees trying to control it, and in the end it comes back to, you know, haunt. And and some, you know, some farmers have just lost their entire crop this year because of that.
Right, and farmland that's been in their families for hundreds of years. And that, and so, but to look at some of these old maps and do comparisons over years to see how these things have changed and how it's impacted communities and states and everything else. Also in that map collection and from the homepage, there's always the area called places in the news. And those always include maps. But of course, right now you've got Japan on there. And then the Atlantic hurricane tracking chart. And those are maps, and they provide a lot of information about current events that are happening. But it may be information and maps that teachers don't have access to regularly. And it's a wonderful resource for a teacher to use in a classroom. And then, you know, obvious connections with the Library of Congress. And I'm an old language arts teacher, so this is where my passion goes immediately. But with social studies and history, and now, you know, with the Common Core standards and everything, that those social studies and language arts are being connected even more, and that, you know, using those maps to research impact on communities and culture, and especially things like the Dust Bowl, and how when the Dust Bowl occurred, when those dust storms occurred, all of the families and all of the livelihoods that changed. And so, you know, I went into American Memory and looked for dust storm and found just amazing artifacts, photographs and letters and things, and that, but they were in, you know, the photographs from the FSAOWI Office of, that's the Farm Security Administration and Office of War Information, but they had photographs from 1935 to 1945. And those included, like, the Dorothea Lange and a lot of those really amazing photos. And especially rural life was presented. And then within the American Life Histories, another collection. And these, again, were the Federal Writers Project. Folks went out and collected stories from people and told about their experiences during this time. So you're learning about the natural disaster, but you're learning how it impacted these families. And, you know, maybe that's something students can connect to. And then the last one related to the Dust Bowl specifically was the voices from the Dust Bowl. And those were, again, interviews that students can listen to. And, you know, there's audio. Most of them were collected from migrant work camps, and they were just documentation trips. So they just documented those stories.
And then, of course, with the Dust Bowl, you can tie that into migration and moving out west because of the, you know, catastrophic effects on the economy there. In the heartland of America.
Right. And so, you know, all these things connect together. And even though, especially when we get in the upper grades and we have our own little worlds of within our disciplines that we live in, you know, the fingers reach out into the other disciplines. And so, you know, if we can help a student that's also at the same time taking another class connect to that material. And then, you know, beyond that, just the different places to look was just some examples of taking it to the classroom that, you know, we try to do every time and that. And there were two specific activities. One is a lesson plan that we'll link to that's called Natural Disasters, Nature's Fury. And this one is really cool because it's for grades 6 through 12. But it has a lot of the different disasters in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. And it has how these were documented through motion pictures, panoramic photos, personal accounts, and song lyrics. And it actually looks at things like the Great Chicago Fire, the San Francisco earthquake, the Jamestown flood, the Dust Bowl, the 1918 flu epidemic, blizzard of 1888, Galveston hurricane, Wisconsin fire. So a lot of different things, a lot of different ones, not just the big ones that we hear about all the time. And that, but looking at those and seeing how different people told their stories about how they were impacted by these. And it's neat because you see how their lives were very different at all of those different times. But they all had homes and families, and that was what where it shook them to their very core when their loved ones and their homes right. were threatened.
And then, you know, going back to the primary sources on the interviews, I mean, there's nothing more personal than hearing the first account
right.
you know, from the affected individuals.
Yeah, and so, you know, and that is something, again, students can usually relate to. Mm-hmm. That's something they can connect with. And then, you know, the last one was topics within Chronicling America, and that's the newspaper collection within the Library of Congress.
Yeah, I've not really had a chance to look at that, but I need to make some time, and I think you've got a link here, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, and it's and we'll add a couple of other ones too as well, but it's overwhelming, just like everything yeah. at the Library of Congress is. It's huge, but I like this specific activity because it looks just at the Great San Francisco Earthquake, but list different articles that are available. But one of the articles is from Washington Time. One is from the Paducah Sun. Mm-hmm. One's from Salt Lake City, Utah, Florida, California, Virginia. So you have these articles from different areas talking about this event. Different people heard at different times about what happened. And what is a huge, just like now, what is a major event in one town to another town barely gets a blip, you mm-hmm. know. Mm-hmm. In the newspaper, mm-hmm. because depending on where you are and what your life is like.
Right.
And that. And so this is a neat way to show students how information is presented differently by different people, mm-hmm. and that they need to use their own skills to get what they can from information. And it's important to get multiple pieces of information right. mm-hmm. and look at those diverse pieces right. and then
right.
use their own brain and come up right. with their ideas of how they, you know, how they feel about a topic.
Right. And it wouldn't take too much effort to go through and, you know, find examples of bias, for example, one paper reporting this way and another paper reporting a little bit different slant.
Yep, absolutely. And in Chronicling America, it's really cool because you can look by topic or date or location and all these different areas. So, you know, the real point, I guess, of this little piece we're doing is just to show, don't think it's just history. Don't forget about the Library of Congress, because their whole goal is to provide tools to teachers to use in their classroom at no cost mm-hmm. that they can access and they can trust that they'll be there next year and the year after and the year after mm-hmm. if they want to use them. But again, you know, download them, put them on your smart board, put them on your computers, on your CD or DVD, whatever, however you want to use them. Mm-hmm. And they're available for you.
Okay.
And but also by using things, you can use the maps, the documents, the photos, the music, and so on, or interviews. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, just kind of personalizing history mm-hmm. and history that could be science.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, well, thank you very much. And you've thought about the topic for next month?
I have. I'm kind of excited about this one because this is something that I know you've been talking about. I've seen it in your tweets mm-hmm. and that I think about a lot as well. Because Veterans Day is 11-11-11, we have some things we've done with patriotic music for each branch of the military. And it's actually one of the most popular parts of our website. Mm-hmm. We get hundreds of hits every month on that mm-hmm. of people accessing, where we have the audio as well as the sheet music and a little background information about each of those songs. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, we'll do a little bit with that, but also talk about what music is available at the Library of Congress and what rules are out there. As teachers, we cite who it comes from, but there are guidelines as to how much of the music we can use and what we can use it mm-hmm. for. And so I thought we would talk about that and really look into what copyright, fair use, and different regulations are regarding music mm-hmm. and how we can incorporate that into our classroom use to, once again, just give students another way to learn about the topic that's under study mm-hmm. and see it, you know, in a little different perspective. And we all know they like their music.
Right.
And that there's a reason they listen to what they listen to. Mm-hmm. And hopefully they'll understand when they hear some of this music. There's a reason that song was written as well.
Okay. Well, we look forward to that. So let's go ahead and wrap it up. And thanks again.
Thank you.
My technology pick of the week this week is from the recent Amazon event held Wednesday in New York City. Amazon announced three new Kindle devices to add to their staple of ebook readers, but the big news of the event was the affordable prices that will most likely bring the use of ebooks to the masses. The lowest cost device is the all-new Kindle, coming in at a price of $79. The middle model comes in two flavors and is called the Kindle Touch. One has Wi-Fi with a price of $99, and the Kindle Touch 3G that has Whisper Sync that allows the purchase and downloading of content over the 3G network. The big news of the day, however, is the new Kindle Fire that is a color tablet similar to the iPad, but less than half the cost with a starting price of $199. The Kindle Fire not only is an e-book reader, but is also a tablet device that can play back HD movies and also download apps from the Amazon store. These prices are the most affordable we have seen to date and most likely will give e-books a boost with the general public. That wraps it up for episode 124 of Tech Talk for Teachers. I want to thank the 2011 Illinois Teacher of the Year Award winner, Anise Brave, for sharing her presentation. I also want to thank Dr. Rich for her Teaching with Primary Sources segment on natural disasters this month. Show notes for this episode and archived episodes are available on the web at the EIU Instructional Technology Center website at eiu.edu/ITC. To leave a comment or suggestion, please send an email to techtalk@eiu.edu or leave a comment on the Tech Talk for Teachers blog. Until next time, this is Tom Grissom. Keep on learning.